This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer. Talk about a successful Zoomer career change. Zoomer Media alumnus Sue Hinsenbergs is celebrating the publication of her first novel in Canada, the US, and the UK, as well as the sale of the film rights. She drops by the Zoomerplex. And we've been hearing a lot about Alberta separatism lately. We'll get the background on the grievances and the history. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Early results from a study of a combination vaccine for flu and COVID-19 show that the combo jab generated a stronger immune response in people aged 50 and up. The mRNA technology is currently used in approved COVID shots but has not been approved for the flu. Drug maker Moderna says the use of mRNA could speed up production of flu shots and believes a combo shot might improve vaccination rates. Side effects included injection site pain, fatigue, and headaches. A pair of British World War II vets were among the first to get a glimpse of a new commemorative coin to mark 80 years since VE Day. 98-year-old Ryan Horsey and Richard Pelzer, 101, both had served with the Royal Engineers and were invited to the Royal Mint to strike one of the first coins. The 50 pence coin features a dove of peace and the inscription, "In Peace, Goodwill." The Royal Mint has a long tradition of marking significant events in history, including stories of the Second World War and the 80th anniversary of D-Day. If you're planning a cruise this spring or summer, rough seas could be the least of your worries. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention predicts a surge in outbreaks of a new strain of norovirus on cruise ships due in part to recent cuts by the Trump administration. 18 million people board cruises in North America every year, many of them Canadians. The Stanford University physician who played an important role in establishing neonatal care has died at the age of 94. In the late 1950s and early 60s, before Dr. Philip Sunshine became interested in caring for preemies, more than half of them died shortly after birth. Dr. Sunshine helped develop methods of feeding preemies and aiding their breathing with the use of ventilators. He also trained thousands of doctors who went on to work in neonative intensive care units around the world. When he retired in 2022 at the age of 92, the survival rate for babies born at 28 weeks was over 90%. The world's oldest woman is living in the UK but can't understand what all the fuss is about. Ethel Caterham, at 115 years and 252 days, reached the milestone following the death of a Brazilian nun last week at the age of 116. Caterham is the last surviving subject of Edward VII and says the secret to her longevity is to never argue with anyone, to listen, and then do what I like. Caterham is also one of the oldest people to survive COVID after contracting it in 2020 at the age of 110. She has spent the last 50 years living at a care home in Surrey, England, and continued driving until she was 97. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Many Zoomers dream of writing a novel, but making that dream a reality is no simple task. And if you're not famous, selling the book and finding an audience is even harder. But Zoomer Media alumnus Sue Hinsenbergs is celebrating the perfect debut with her book, The Retirement Plan. Sue Hinsenbergs, it's so good to see you here.
Oh, it's so great to be back. I really enjoyed my time here.
Oh, yes, and we enjoyed your time here too. And talk about the successful Zoomer career change. You pivoted to do something so many people dream about, write a novel. And boy, has it been successful. It's on the shelves in three countries, Canada, the US, and the UK. And you even have movie rights.
That's right. Yeah, it's been like dream come true territory.
And when did you first know that you wanted to do this?
It goes way back. It's like when I was 20, if you can believe it, I went to a Bruce Springsteen concert. And if anybody's been to one of his concerts, they know that man is really magnetic. And he would talk about dreams and he talked about having them and not giving up on them. I was 20 years old. I was two rows from the rafters at Maple Leaf Gardens. And I promised Bruce, who I've never met, and me, 20-year-old me, that I would never give up on my dream to write a novel.
And so how did you make it happen?
Well, the next thing that happened to me, fast forward like 40 years, and I was at a funeral and somebody, you know, in casual conversation just asked, when are you retiring? And it just hit my heart like an arrow.
Oh, I know exactly how you feel.
Yeah. I was like, retiring. It's like, how old do you think I am? And I am that old. And when did that happen? And I realized then, the only really plan I had about my retirement was I pictured myself always writing, and there I was almost 60 and I'd never written anything. And I thought, if I want that dream, I better get going on it. And it was like, if not now, when?
And how long between that and the time you actually started doing it?
Well, probably I started writing that summer. That would be the summer of 2020. I had 6 weeks off between shows and I sat down, opened a Word doc, began writing, and then did not write very well for a couple of years. And then finally started the retirement plan in January 2023. And that, once I wrote that book and sent that out, then I was on my way.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about the plot of the book.
Well, it's about four couples that have been friends for 30 years. Four couples. Yep. They met when their kids were little in sports. And then, you know, the kids grow up and move away and all that stuff. But the parents maintain their friendship. They still get together. And they're ready to retire, but they can't afford to because a few years back, the husbands made a bad investment and lost their money. So you can imagine how that went down at home, right?
And they all made this investment together.
Yep, they did. The wives didn't know about it. The husbands made it. So since then, the wives are just shell-shocked. Like the marriages have withered from the blame and the shame. They're just going through the motions. They're not happy in their marriages. And they're all resigned to work until they die. But then one of the husbands dies in an accident and his wife rebounds with this huge insurance payout. And these other wives take a look at this and then soon realize their own husbands have the same insurance coverage. And being in these dead marriages anyway, they realize, like, what are these guys to us anymore? We don't have sex anymore. We don't have fun. What are they beyond a lump on the sofa and a mouth at the table? Like, you know, let's kill them, get the money, and go to, and retire in Florida. And so they hire a hitman. But what they don't realize is that these husbands aren't necessarily the duds they think they are, and they're working on something on their own, and they've already hired that same hitman for a job of their own.
To kill the wives.
Well, maybe not. Maybe a job of their own. We'll leave it at that. No spoilers here. You know?
And so you write this book that you have in you. But I mean, I'm amazed. So it's not just being published here in Canada, which is a bit of a miracle, especially if you're not a household name.
Yeah.
It's being published in the US, the UK, being translated, and you sold the film rights.
Yeah. I know. It was crazy. My whole attitude towards this was I had like three different mantras I had. One was, if not now, when? Because, you know, I was 60. I'm 64 now, and it takes a while to write a book and get it published. So I was in my 60s. Why not me? Like, somebody has to do this, write books. Like, you know, why not me? And shoot for the stars. It was just when I was looking at agents and however to go through this process, I just thought, like, yeah, I'm just going to shoot for the stars. I have nothing to lose. It's an email. I did a lot of research on the process and figured out who to shoot to and did. And it was kind of cool because I sat in my own den writing the book. I laughed. I thought it was funny. I cried. I thought it had heart. I didn't know if anybody else would feel that way. And then when I finally sent it out in the world, it got like swept up right away by like the book professionals. And then it was like off and running.
Who picked it up first?
Well, the first step was to get an agent. I got a super agent out of the UK who reps the Thursday Murder Clubs and that book, which is a really popular series. And then that agent sent it off and simultaneously to the UK and the US. So HarperCollins is publishing it in the US and Canada, and Hachette Sphere is publishing it in the UK. And then almost simultaneously, the film rights sold as well.
And the agent took care of that?
Yeah. The tricky part's finding the agent. And there's lots of resources online to how you do that and choose the agent. You need to find an agent that will take the book, like your kind of book, and knows where to sell it. They pitch it to the publishing houses. I left it all in their hands, and they dealt with that.
Generally, my thought was that you have to be some kind of famous person to sell a book.
Well, no. Because everybody's looking for a good story, right? Wherever it comes from. And agents, of which there's thousands of them, have these things they call the slush piles, where people query them. It's like cold calling an agent. And you have to write a very specific pitch letter. And then they ask for a sample of your writing. And it's always the first part of a book, be it the first 5 pages, 10 pages, 3 chapters, whatever. And you send them off. And I know these agents, they get sometimes like 150 to 500 a week of these submissions. And they go through these letters. So you have to be very clear and concise and hopefully catch them. And if they'll read the letter, then they go to the pages. If they like the pages, they'll email you back and say, I like what I've read so far. Send me the whole book. And then you send them the whole book. And then you hope they read that and come back to you and say, I really like it. I think I can sell it. I'd like to talk to you about that.
These are four couples, dead marriages. Mm-hmm. So one would almost surmise that you're projecting something from your life, but apparently you're happily married.
Well, I am. Actually, we'll be married 34 years next month, but you do have to write what you know. And so there's grievances in these marriages. And so I mind my own marriage for those. Like my husband, he didn't read the book for a long time, not till after it was sold. Like I would talk plot points with him. And I would say to him, like, if four men are on a boat, would they talk about their marriages like this, that type of stuff? And I had input from that. But he never read the whole thing until after it sold. And he was sitting down, I could hear him in the other room, he'd be reading and he'd be like, oh, come on. I know what it was about. Because we have a thing about like shoes in the hall, right?
Shoes anywhere.
Yeah, like they don't need to be there. And like in the bathroom, his clothes look like he's been vaporized out of them. They're just like right there. And so coincidentally, so does the main character in the novel, right? They have those same kind of issues with their husband.
Anything else you want to share with us?
Well, just that the whole journey, I really didn't know if I could do it, right? And I just sat down and I thought, I looked for any kind of encouragement I ever had. And I debated whether I should keep going because it was taking a lot of time. But the bottom line was, I thought the only thing I knew for sure was that if I didn't try, nothing would happen. So I just kept at it. And for me, it's really reaffirming in that I went for it and it's kind of happening. It's worked out well. Like I have the deal. The books are in airports now, you know, all kinds of stores. It was sold out on Amazon the morning it came out.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They've just restocked now. So it's just like, why not? Right? Why not try?
How long did it take you?
It took me to write that book. It took 6 months. I started January 2023. I started looking for an agent 6 months later. And then I finally had an agent in October. We sold it in November. And so it's a year and a half from the time it's sold to when it's actually coming out. But that's a long process.
And the others that didn't work out?
Oh, they're gone. Nobody will ever see them. You know what? I'm glad I wrote them because I improved my craft and it taught me to more about writing than I knew. It pushed me to get into writing groups, which was the smartest thing I did. I joined these critique groups and I had objective eyes on my pages and good advice. So that was really good. That was the most constructive thing I did. And if I hadn't written those books, I wouldn't have found that for the retirement plan. So by the time I got to the retirement plan, I think my craft was better and hopefully it'll keep getting better, you know?
And so again, but how much time for those books that didn't work out?
I probably spent 2 years on those. Yeah. From the summer of 2020 is when I started till the end of December 22. And then I just gave up on them because they were like 150 rejections. And I thought, okay, I can take a hint, you know, and then I moved on to something else. I remember thinking about those books. I bet you if somebody died in one of these books, I could sell it. So in the retirement plan, somebody dies on page 3. That's not a spoiler.
It worked. It worked. Yeah. Sue Hinsenberg's congratulations and thanks for sharing your journey. And
wow.
Well, thank you.
I'm impressed.
Oh, great. Well, and it's not easy to impress you. So that's great.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Sue Hinsenberg, author of The Retirement Plan. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, what we need to know about Alberta separatism.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
It's been a factor for a long time, but many of us Central Canadians are hearing about it for the first time. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith says she will undertake a referendum on separating from Canada if enough Albertans say they want it. So how serious is the threat and what's behind it? I reached author Michael Wagner in Edmonton. Many of us Central Canadians have not heard much about Alberta separatism until very recently. Why is that?
Well, the separatist movement has not been strong in recent years. It came on the scene in about 1970 when Pierre Trudeau became prime minister. He did some things that essentially created a separatist movement in Western Canada and especially in Alberta. And it has periods where it rises in strength and falls and dissipates. And so it hasn't been very strong in recent years. And so now that with this election of Mark Carney, it's really sparked the movement to become alive again. And so it's very strong in Alberta right now, and that's why you're hearing about it now.
Okay. And what about the election of Mark Carney brought it to the fore?
Well, we look at the election of Mark Carney essentially as a continuation of Justin Trudeau's administration. Of course, Justin Trudeau was in power for approximately 9.5 years, and we saw many of his policies as being hostile to Alberta, like especially the climate change policies that would prevent the construction of pipelines and now like an emissions cap on oil production and things like that. There was also what we call the Alberta tanker ban, where we wouldn't be able to export oil off of the coast of BC. There were several policies he brought in as part of his climate change agenda we felt were targeting Alberta. And so with the election of Mark Carney, we see it as a continuation of those kind of policies rather than the kind of change that Albertans were looking for with Pierre Poilievre.
And Carney has sort of said that he would not continue that way. Is that how you read it?
Yes, that's what he said. And, you know, he has a real opportunity. If he does do those kinds of things that he talks about, he could really let the air out of the sails of the separatist movement. So the ball is in his court in that sense. If he actually takes, you know, concrete steps to reduce the effect on Alberta of those policies, that would take the air out of the sails of the separatist movement here.
So you were saying that the history of this type of thing goes back before Pierre Trudeau.
Well, like Western discontent has always been part of the political scene in Canada, like right from the beginning of the Prairie Provinces, say in the early 20th century, there were various farmers' movements and other political movements because we felt that we weren't being properly treated within Canada. But none of those movements advocated for independence. They just would advocate for changes within Canada. And that change with Pierre Trudeau, some of the policies he brought in, especially on energy-related issues, led to the first creation of separatist organizations in Alberta. So I call Pierre Trudeau the father of the Alberta separatist movement.
Okay. Now, the recent thing, there are people who point to the Premier, Danielle Smith, saying, well, she is fomenting or encouraging this, even though she kind of tries to play both sides of the fence, I think.
Yeah, I think she's caught in a bad spot there because there are MLAs in her caucus who are sympathetic to Alberta independence, and then there are those who are not. And so she's trying to walk a fine line. On the one hand, she's, you know, declaring herself a Federalist, saying that she's opposed to Alberta separation. But on the other hand, she's changing the rules for a citizen initiative so that citizens, if they get enough signatures, could force the government to hold a referendum on independence. So by taking the position she is, she's trying to cater to both sides, if you will.
Well, my understanding is that now it would take something like 600,000 signatures, but her changes would reduce that number a lot to like 170 or something.
Yeah, it would be below 200,000 anyway, so it would make it much easier for a citizen organization to get the number of signatures necessary. She's also extended the time period to give them more time to get those signatures. So the changes that she's made make it, I think, very likely that some organization will be able to achieve the number of signatures they need and force a referendum.
And what do you think the outcome of a referendum would be? How serious is this threat?
It's a serious threat in a sense, but the federal government could take steps. You know, if the federal government reached out to Alberta and started making some compromises like we talked about earlier with Mark Carney, he could really defeat the referendum that way by, you know, showing concern for what Alberta's been worried about with these climate change policies. So it would really depend, I think, on the federal government. If the federal government took a hard stand against Alberta and continued to move forward with the kind of climate change policies that Justin Trudeau brought in, I think the possibility of a yes vote on independence would be higher. But if the federal government is more accommodating toward Alberta, they'll reduce that likelihood by quite a bit.
Mark Carney, I mean, he was a huge advocate of climate change and policies to address it. He's written a book about it. So do you believe that he is going to turn his back on that? And he advocated a carbon tax before saying that he would get rid of part of it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, someone like me, I'm quite skeptical of, you know, his current position. Like, he's talking about making Canada an energy superpower that would require Alberta's oil and gas industry to thrive. And yet, like you say, that kind of contradicts what he's written in the past. So I'm skeptical that he'll do what Alberta would like him to do in terms of restraining the climate change policies. I'm skeptical of that. But, you know, you got to give the guy a chance, I guess.
Okay. Anything else you want to leave us with?
No, I just, it would be very good for, you know, people in Central Canada to understand, you know, the history of discontent out here and why just one election, you know, it seems like one election has led to the rise of a large movement, but that movement has existed before due to, you know, previous problems we've had with the federal government. And the current uproar of Alberta separatism is not something that occurred just out of the blue from the perspective of us here, because we've had that movement come and go over a period of the last several decades.
Okay. Michael Wagner, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Michael Wagner, author of Alberta Separatism, Then and Now. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi and Christine Ross, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.